Going all the way back to the beginnings of language, meaningful communication between human beings has been built on the foundation of storytelling. It's no surprise that the truly great artists of spoken word media are skillful storytellers, particularly in the field of talk radio that relies almost exclusively on oral input and the theater of the mind. Our guest this week is one such outstanding individual. He's the host and founder of Our American Stories, a storytelling radio show and podcast featuring narratives that represent the best of America: history, sports, music, free enterprise, charity, faith, family, and more. It can be heard 5 days a week, 2 hours a night, on well over 220 affiliates across the country. And archives of the show are available as a tremendous series of podcasts. In 2021, Our American Stories was signed to a syndication deal with Premier Networks, a subsidiary of iHeartMedia, that's given it an added layer of distribution muscle. Our guest was ranked 12th in the Talkers 2022 Heavy 100, the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America. Ranked in the 30th and 14th position in 20 and 21 respectively, he has dramatically moved up the ladder during the three-year period, and I expect that he'll continue his upward ascent when the new list is posted later this month. Our guest this week is Lee Habib. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify. I can be reached directly by email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Lee Habib. How the hell are you?
I am just listening to the Quint scene on the boat in Jaws, the Indianapolis tale that he tells.
Yeah.
And it is so... I'm writing a piece on the Indianapolis right now. I'm performing it for Our American Stories. But I have the real-life Quint, the last living Marine, telling the real story about what happened, not just the actor.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. So it's so much fun to do this because I get to do this and connect this shark tale that everyone thinks they know from the most, probably one of the most watched movies of all time and the best scene in that movie to these were real people. And so I go from writing that story to bringing in Edgar Harrell, who just recently died. He was the last Marine to survive the Indianapolis sinking. And he tells that story of when you're watching his buddies get torn up by sharks.
You know, it's amazing. It's amazing how so many stories of history and so many iconic stories that we learned in school or that we see immortalized in movies, that they're very far from the truth. That we almost have this mythical reality that that we've grown up in and live in. And I guess that's why storytelling is important. It really is, isn't it?
Yep. I don't know how societies, you know, if we don't get the stories right about ourselves or our families. I was talking to somebody the other day, Michael, about this. And, you know, a couple celebrating their 25th anniversary, right? And they had some problems in their life. Maybe there was an infidelity by the man or the woman, or maybe there was some arguments, and maybe they were looking at divorce at some point, but they got through it. Can you imagine doing the celebration of that family by only talking about the bad parts of that marriage?
Mm-hmm. Or the
that's what's happening now. That's what's happening in America right now with the teaching of our history.
Yeah.
It is warts without context.
Yeah. Or the skewed parts of the relationship, you know, one person's view. You know, the old saying, every story has this two sides to every story. There are many sides to every story. And there have been all kinds of, I can't think of the exact words, but there have been sayings, you know, history is told by the victors, you know, and all that. I have been rolling the tape, to use an anachronism, while we've been talking to get levels. But some of the things we've just said are interesting. So are you okay if we just continue to talk and record this?
Yeah.
Because I have been particularly thinking about this issue of stories. I just watched for the first time the movie Tombstone. With Kurt Russell and all those great actors, it sparked me to try to do a little research on the history of the gunfight at the OK Corral, which my generation grew up with it, countless movies and stories, and I was thinking about the same thing we've just talked about, how amazing it is that nobody's got it right. there's so many different points of view as to what was said, where it was, how it happened, what the relationship was, who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. Sometimes there are good bad guys and bad good guys. It's amazing how that works. So you have one of the most, you have a unique, the most unique, you have a unique property within the talk media realm, particularly talk radio, not only in the content, but also in your business structure. And I have been following you now. How long has it been since Our American Stories has been launched? How many years has it been?
Almost 6 years.
Wow. And I knew right away when I first met you and I saw and heard the concept that you were going to be doing something very special, because you are not somebody from outside the business. You've been in the radio business for years. You've worked with some of the top people, and you brought that to the table. And it really has turned out to be a shining light of potential ways of doing talk media beyond the typical left-right political take phone calls, only talk to people that want to hear what you have to say, reaffirm their opinions, and all of, reaffirmation, the daily dance of reaffirmation, as I call it. And you've been tremendously successful with this. What's the latest on Our American Stories, simply as a media property? And then I want to get into some of the nuts and bolts of exactly what you're doing.
Well, Michael, as a property, the iHeart deal that we signed, Julie Talbot and the Premier people were so gracious to take our show on and syndicate it nationally. So we're on in the evenings on some of the biggest stations in the country. I couldn't have imagined that WFLA or WHO or WBT or WKTRH or KRLD would take our show, and so many others. I apologize for not mentioning them all, because it started as an independent syndication program, but I was always hoping it would get picked up by iHeart and Premier. They're the Yankees of this game. And when we got the call from Julie, we were so touched. But what's really been remarkable, Michael, is our growth on the podcasting front. We've gone from 20,000 downloads a month, which was where we were in about 2021, to now we're approaching 800,000. So we have seen a 40-fold increase in our downloads, and it's just steady month-over-month growth. And we attribute that in large measure to the fact that none of the stuff we're doing is tied to the news. You know, you can listen to Dan Patrick do his sports broadcast today or listen to Sean Hannity, but you're not going to go back and listen to the sports news from a month ago because you already know what happened. Mm-hmm. You're not going to go back and listen to even some of the best Rush Limbaugh. And I love, we wouldn't have had a business without Rush. But the old Rush Limbaugh shows are about senators we don't remember, fights and issues that are long gone. And the idea that we were going to make evergreen content that would be good to be listened to anywhere and any time, it's turning out that when people discover us, Michael, they're going, wow, I like that Dale Earnhardt story. I didn't know that the Intimidator died by being the protector. He was trying to protect his two teammates in this particular race. And then we get into the whole life of Dale Earnhardt. Well, when somebody bumps into that one, they go, huh, John Wooden. Huh, Mike Krzyzewski. Huh, Bear Bryant. And that's just sports. We also do music. We do Ray Charles. We do so many music. Dizzy Gillespie, Duke Ellington. Sidney Poitier in film, The Godfather. We have a great Star Wars story about how Star Wars didn't happen. And so whatever, or history, I mean, we have so many great history stories from guys like Stephen Ambrose and David McCullough, that when people find the thing they like, they go and listen to more. And so what we're finding is when we onboard a new fan, the fan can go back into that catalog and keep going while waiting for the new stuff to come as well. That bet, which is a strange bet 6 years ago, Michael, to say that we're going to do stuff on News Talk that's not the news, was a gamble. But in the end, it paid off, because I think no matter how we vote, left or right, most Americans love their country. Most Americans have some interesting and positive stories to tell about their country. And we're looking to unite around common values, the shared love of freedom of religion, the freedom of conscience, the shared love of freedom of speech, the shared love of so many things like free enterprise and property rights. And why people come here from everywhere. Why do they come here, I think, is the real thing we're trying to ask. Not what's wrong with America. I can get a long list of what's wrong with myself. But if 10 people said, what's Lee good at? Why is Lee good? Or why is America good? Or why is this family good? That's the interesting question we're asking. What makes America good? Not great. What makes it good? Because if it wasn't a good country, then my Lebanese grandparents wouldn't have come here. My Italian grandparents wouldn't have come here. And my wife's Irish immigrant family wouldn't have come here. They come here for a reason, and they're still coming here. They're crossing borders, Michael. They're risking their life to come here. It can't be that bad a place. So we celebrate the good. And that's another thing that I think the media has a bias against. Forget left-wing bias or right-wing bias or whatever you think. The big bias is the train wreck. The media likes to sell the catastrophe, the murder, the fire. We say, well, that's nice, but what about selling the story of George Washington surrendering his commission? Most Americans don't know that I think the greatest American of all time, George Washington, surrendered his commission. And that's not a thing we can have an argument about, whether that's good or bad. That's so remarkable. That's so amazing that to leave that fact out of the story of George Washington is nefarious. And so these are the things we try to do, is connect today with the past. George Washington didn't know what was going to happen when he decided to lead a battered army of troops against the mighty British. He had no idea what would happen, but he and those patriots unleashed an era of human freedom that no one's ever seen before in the world. Well, and that's what we really want to cover, the awe of what this country has been for so many people. We can argue about what's wrong with it all day long. We can argue about what our dad didn't do right or what our dad did wrong. But was our dad present? Was he a good dad? Well, if you're lucky enough to have a good dad who is present, you don't know how blessed you are. Talk to people who don't have fathers about how blessed you are. And I think this is how we approach our storytelling about America, with a certain degree of awe and reverence and love.
Well, history relates to the present. You mentioned it doesn't relate to News Talk, you know, and then, of course, you contradicted yourself in a very positive way that of course, history relates to the current news. And without having history, we don't fully understand the roots and the significance, the foundation of the news. When you were mentioning before about sports talk and history or old Rush Limbaugh shows, and I do understand that old contemporary stuff, it does seem very dated very quickly, especially the way things change today. But I have noticed there's a trend, and your show is a counterpoint to that trend. There's a trend in the media today, even in news talk media and sports talk media, not to talk about the past. Somehow there's the feeling among management that if you talk about the past, it makes you sound like a nostalgia freak or an old person, and young people don't care about what happened 20 years ago or 15 years ago. My friends in sports talk radio complain all the time about when they talk about the old timers or games they saw as a kid or great players of the past. The management says, don't do that. It sounds like you're old. And so I think that makes us dumber as a country. So you're serving the present interests of an enlightened public by telling these stories. And I congratulate you on that. Because so many people listening to this program are in the media industry, I want to ask you two questions about what you brought up at the beginning. First of all, is your relationship with Premiere, do they own the show now, or are they distributors? Are they distributors of the show for you?
The distributors, and we co-own the intellectual property that we're doing as we're doing it.
I see. So they do have a stake in it more than just a contract for distribution.
Yeah.
That's very good to hear, which means if they believe in that, because, you know, they're about as big and as representative of the state of the art for all its good and all its bad as anybody out there. So the fact that iHeart and Premiere recognize the value of this type of a relatively offbeat approach to contemporary talk radio is a very encouraging thing. The other question I have is, you mentioned the podcast is getting enormous attention and traction. What is the relationship between the programming of the podcast and the programming of the show? Are they the same entities, or is there a difference? And how does that work?
No, we take the same 2 hours that we do nightly, and we have a third hour for a few affiliates available. But we take the prime 2 hours. We just offer it up as a choice menu. So, you know, on any given day, there'll be 5 or 6 stories, sometimes 8, sometimes 2. Sometimes they're just 2-hour-long stories. Sometimes they're 8. It just depends. And then the menu has a great title and a little description, and people can choose for that day the story, 2 or 3 they want to listen to.
So the affiliates who run the show on a schedule on the air, and they obviously run the new product as it's being developed, there's a harmonious relationship between the on-air new stuff and the fact that people can plug into a whole archive of the same basic programs through digital means?
Yep, and those digital means, you get to hear them first on the air at night or wherever we're carried that day. And then the next morning we release the podcast version.
Okay, so you can hear, it's not that different than NBC Peacock with the new Law & Orders or Paramount Plus.
That's right.
Very, very interesting. Just generally off the top of your head, what are your thoughts about the state of podcasting and its relationship with talk radio?
Well, I think it's a new medium, and I think that it's a different medium. And I think in the same way that theater and film are different, I think that podcasting and the art of podcasting and the art of radio are in some dimensions different, but in many dimensions the same. Same with acting. I mean, stage acting and film acting have many things in common, but they also have things that are different. You know, I don't know that a guy like Jordan Peterson could be a great radio host. But my goodness, what a podcaster. And yet some podcasters, I think, would make great radio hosts. So I think that they're separate entities. You have to treat them differently and think about them differently and think about, how do I make a product that works in both mediums? Think about that and work through it. And again, particularly when we pull away the time. Like when I'm listening to radio, it's live. It's immediate. I'm coming to it now for the news. I'm coming to it now for the weather. I'm coming to it now for the sports scores. That's good, but that's also ephemeral. That means it doesn't have any value tomorrow. So how do we, and that's what I was trying to solve with Our American Stories. The fights we're having today, we have had before, Michael. A quick example, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton were buddies. They wrote the Federalist Papers together, for goodness sake. So imagine these are young men, brilliant men, living in contemporary America at the time, not knowing what the future was going to be, but then we start to govern. And pretty quickly, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton go to war. Because Hamilton is sort of the big city, big bank guy. And James Madison is going, well, not too fast. I'm a rural guy. And the beginning of the rural city divide began in the 18th century. And we still have it. Upstate New York is more like Oxford, Mississippi than New York City is to Biloxi. In other words, our big cities have more in common around the country than our, despite geography, than our rural places do. So rural upstate New York and rural California and rural Alabama are very much the same. They vote the same because they live the same, Michael. They live the same. And so what we love to do in our show is highlight that some things don't change. Some arguments aren't terrible. They're not bad. The nation's been divided from the beginning. The Revolutionary War, we were divided. A third of the Americans wanted the war, the Patriots. A third, the Loyalists, said, why are we fighting the British? They're not taxing us much. Let's leave them alone. And a third were hiding under their tables. Mm-hmm. And the Civil War was a slight disagreement, right? I mean, oh my goodness. So the idea that America has always been like on the same page.
Right. Or that we're at each other's throats now, you know, like we've always been at each other's throats.
We've always been at each other's throats. The difference is that we don't have coups every minute, that we continue to have property rights, continue to have functioning markets, continue to have freedom of speech. I had a friend of mine from Uganda who said to me one day, he was at an event where people were talking to the President of the United States. And they were disagreeing with him on a stage. And he, as we're leaving, goes, do you know how remarkable what you just saw was in Uganda? If you disagreed with Idi Amin, you died.
Immediately. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, that's an extreme example, but it certainly is true. It really is true.
By the way, Michael, it's true in about a third to a half of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Still, try doing that in China.
Well, right? Certainly.
Jack Ma, who runs Alibaba, said a harsh word about Chairman Xi. He's not a president. He's the chairman of the Communist Party,
right?
And he's the general secretary of the Communist Party's army, right? So this is the army of the Communist Party. Jack Ma disappeared for 9 months, one of the richest men in the world. Disappeared.
Yeah, we do take this for granted. And in some cases, we actually see it as a problem when people disagree. The thing that frustrates me is people see dissent as a bad thing in America, when in fact dissent is purely American. It's a very strange paradox that if we're too united, we will fall. that we have to be slightly disunited. And it's just a matter of maintaining that balance, which takes, again, a knowledge of history, and it takes critical thinking. It takes a basically honest media, which I have questions about today. But then again, that's always been a problem, too. Yellow journalism goes all the way back to the beginning of time. And we have to have an educational system that is depoliticized and deals with the things that we need to learn for critical thinking and get the politics out of it.
Michael, our most important day is our Constitution Day, in which we have some of the greatest scholars talking about this miracle, right? And what's remarkable about our Constitution is how much power is dispersed. You know, we have a Congress that's 2 years for election. You got a Senate that's six, and you have to get a bill through both. And you've got to get it through two different parties that might be in power in each of them. Then once it's there, it's got to go to an executive branch, a separate branch. That's not true in England. That's not true in France. The prime minister serves at the behest of the parliament in those places. But in America, we make it difficult. And why do we make it difficult? And then if the president, by the way, vetoes, it's got to go back. And then you've got an independent judiciary. Then you've got all these states, and a lot of the power was deferred to the states. And then inside the states, we have the counties and then the municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
And we do all of that because what we don't want is one centralized authority saying, this is what we're going to do.
Yes.
We want all of that dissent. We want all of that disagreement. We want California to try one thing and Alabama to try another thing and New York to try another thing. And then we have this experiment between all of the states competing for resources, competing for talent. And this constitution, it's not perfect because nothing is, but it's the oldest constitution in the world.
Yes.
And most kids don't know that the structure of the constitution, by the way, that's the core of the word. He has a sound constitution. It's the structure. Most Americans don't know that story of how it happened, why it happened, the people who did it, and how miraculous it is that we live under a nation of law and courts and rights and civil rights, Michael, that are actually enforced. One of the great historians, legal historians, Scalia, explains on our show, he's dead now, but he explains how in Russia there's a tremendous Bill of Rights under the old Soviet Union. There's a tremendous Bill of Rights in China, but they're words on paper. They're not enforceable. My favorite segment, and it was a hard segment to do, but it was really an important segment. This guy named David Goldberger, who's Jewish, lived in Illinois, and he was the head of the Illinois ACLU. And a neo-Nazi came into his office and said, I want to be able to give a march in Skokie. Skokie has the most Holocaust survivors of any city in America, and as a percentage. And Goldberger did something that he didn't like doing. He hated the neo-Nazis, but he represented them. And he got a real hard time from a lot of his Jewish friends. And, you know, I understand. And he went to his Jewish friends, and he went to synagogues, and he said, I'm not defending the neo-Nazis. They're odious. They're horrible. But how we counter them is with speech of our own. Because if we eliminate the neo-Nazis' right to speech, then who's next? Hmm. And remember that Jews weren't given the right to criticize Hitler. And nobody was given the right to criticize Hitler. So I'm not fighting for the neo-Nazis. I'm fighting for the First Amendment. And that's the old Voltaire line. I don't agree with you, but I'll defend your right to speak as you'd like in the public square. And that, for us, a fundamental right of this country is that dissent you were talking about.
Yeah,
it makes life interesting. B, it brings odious thoughts to light. So if there is a Klan, I want to know about them. I want to know who they are. I want to know what they think so I can teach my kid and show my kid how wrong they are. But if you don't have free speech, you can create monsters and underground monsters and make them worse and make them more powerful.
I agree, and I'm so thrilled to hear the wisdom that you're spouting on this program today, because I think it's fundamental to the well-being of our society and frankly, to humanity. And that's why we have to keep restating it, retelling the stories, updating the stories, educating our children, and educating ourselves. Let's circle back to the business.
Michael, I wanted to make one more point about this freedom, because here's how important it is. Like, take sports. People would say, why would freedom matter in sports? Well, we do a story of Arnold Palmer. And Arnold Palmer was a golfer, and he was working for Wilson Sporting Goods, was his main benefactor in terms of sponsorships. And one day, Arnold Palmer goes in to ask for a raise, basically. And the head of Wilson at the time says, you know, no golfer should make more money than me. Arnold Palmer walks out, calls his friend Mark McCormick, and starts what is now IMG. He starts Sports Agency. And Arnold Palmer develops golf courses. He develops his own line of clothing. And the next thing you know, we're dealing with Curt Flood. And Curt Flood, the African-American baseball player, said, I should have a right to play where I want. And modern free agency is birthed. We tell those stories too, these great sports and arts stories about why America has the greatest sports and arts. It's because we have the freest artists. Artists can write about anybody they want, anything they want. They can own their intellectual property. So if they write it, they get to keep the intellectual property of that book. And that's Benjamin Franklin. That's Ben Franklin creating that right in our Constitution. So it's not all history, like boring history or serious history. The stories of entrepreneurs, of inventors, all of it, it's because we have patent rights. Because we really so want to secure the rights of individuals to flourish, that this is, I deeply believe, what makes almost all of the aspects of American life so dynamic, so interesting. And again, it's what lures and why America is a magnet for ethnic groups and people from every pocket of this great earth. Everyone wants to live here. It's a really remarkable thing.
Since you brought it up, are you concerned that the advent of artificial intelligence might present really difficult problems for the legal system in terms of intellectual property, trademarks, patents, and other things that protect the artist and the thinker?
Well, we've seen this from the Industrial Revolution on, and even the printing press, right? I mean, if we really think about it, the printing press was like, oh my goodness, what's that, right? Mm. How dangerous is that? Mm-hmm. So we have survived the internet and many of the implications, and with some real negative consequences from social media, what it's doing to young kids, suicide rates. The technology comes and creates opportunities. The technology comes and it creates problems. And that's that, by the way, that's a real recurring part of our story is, you know, what happens when we industrialize America? Well, there's a lot of pollution. There's a lot of abuse in labor. There's all kinds of problems. But my goodness, I don't think we would trade going back to being a nation of farmers and living off the land with no electricity and no power grid. So, you know, there are trade-offs, but I think AI can do good, and I think AI has the potential to do enormous harm. And the question is, how do we deal with that as a society? What conversations do we have about it? How do we regulate it? But I don't think we can stop it. And so the question becomes, you know, what do we do, and what does our political world do to harness that power for more good than bad? Mm. But I think, Michael, every era of technological revolution, heck, if it weren't for the cotton gin, I think slavery would have died. So this cotton gin was both good, but my goodness, the expansion of slavery in the South because of the cotton gin was just, you know, it's a fundamental reason that slavery expanded, a technological advance.
So well put. So well put. I mentioned a few moments ago, I wanted to circle back to something, and I don't want to forget while I have you, because you're dealing with the theater of the mind. And I am correct that Our American Stories and all of its offshoots and its archives and its plans right now are in the field of audio. Am I correct that we're not talking about a visual or a film version of what you're doing?
No, not yet. But that I do believe in the next year to 2 years will start. I always saw this as I always loved ESPN's 30 for 30s because they were branded, and then you had a certain expectation for the excellence with which they were done. Mm-hmm. And just the other night, my wife and I, who are not real pool players and don't follow pool, watched the story of this Asian pool player in America who's female and her life story and her struggles. And we were gripped and cried at the end. And we thought, you know, that when I originally started to see what 30 for 30 was doing, I thought, well, let me start for the first 5 to 10 years just getting the stories down, finding the beginning, the middle, and the end, finding the right people, finding the right historians, finding the right tone, finding the right style. We do our show very uniquely. We don't have interviews on our show. It's one person narrating with some music. It feels like a little film. And ultimately what we want to do is, once we had enough intellectual property, once the show is big enough, then we want to be able to go to a cable company or a network and say, hey, we've got an audience. We already have the stories. We found them. Now we just got to put a camera on them.
Okay, but what about
the hardest part about all of this, as you can imagine, Michael, is finding the story, producing the story, getting a following around Our American Stories. That's the next step. I have a member of our board now, the chairman of our board, is Chip Flaherty. And he founded Walden Media, or Mr. Phil Anschutz. And they've done 25 movies from Chronicles of the Narnia straight to Ray, the Oscar-winning movie. And so that's the next step within 12 to 24 months, is packaging this and also turning it into a once-a-week, three stories in an hour kind of 60 minutes kind of piece, right, which is really compelling stories once a week for Americans to see and not just listen to.
But much of what you've just said is based upon the individual success that your company and your show has had. But to this point of where you've come, what do you have to say about the potential, and do you have praises to sing for the existence and potential of audio media, forgetting growing into, you know, the visual aspect of it? Are you optimistic about the future of audio media, audio podcasts, radio
absolutely.
Shows?
Absolutely. They're different. And I, you know, in the same way that, you know, and what I really like is that we started with audio. And when you start with audio, you actually look and search for things in a different way. And you are evoking things for people to create mental pictures. And so without that audio, we couldn't even think of going to video. And we'll always honor the audio because it's its own separate product. And it's in it, and I think the future for audio is remarkable if we have people who think about audio for audio only. And because an audio version of something is going to be different than a video version of something. And we'd love our audio version, and we're going to continue to do it for as long as Premiere will let us do it and for as long as we can. And by the way, I also think that the reason audio and spoken word have such a long lifespan in front of them is that when people are riding a bike or working out or gardening, they can't watch a video, but they can listen to audio. And so there are many hours in a day where people are working, they're doing things, they're driving. I don't want people watching video when they're driving, but my goodness, the degree to which if somebody really focuses on the nature and quality of the audio storytelling, the better they do that, the better their podcast is going to be, because you've got to create word pictures in your audio. Once that camera's there, you're letting that camera fill in a lot of blanks that you wouldn't have done otherwise. And then your audio is going to suffer. So that's why we're going to always be creating our audio first. Later, we'll bring in the cameras. But it's not going to change how we start and finish anything we do, which is always with that audio product in mind.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with Lee Habib, host and producer of Our American Stories. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a co-presentation of Podcast One and Talkers Magazine, produced by Good Phone Communications, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.